The Pat Kenny Show.
With the Jaguar E-Pace. Beautiful by design and dynamic to drive. Delivering performance that is unmistakably Jaguar.
This is News Talk.
Luke O'Neill, Professor of Biochemistry at Trinity College in Dublin. Good morning.
Good morning, Pat. How's it going?
It's going very well. I feel refreshed after 3 days just doing absolutely nothing. Thanks to Jonathan for standing in. Now, we've lots of things to talk about today. And first of all, the views of eminent epidemiologists as to when we will get back to normal. Explain.
This is good, Pat. So, you know, they've interviewed now over 500 epidemiologists, mainly in the US, it must be said, but also a big report by the New York Times, Reuters, National Public Radio have produced this list of what's risky and what isn't, and also when we're going to come out of this space. What's the future look like, especially in America? So now, as you know, Pat, scientists often differ. We're seeing this in debate at the moment, aren't we? And they look for a consensus view, especially with something complicated. So it's good because these epidemiologists have all said the following things are high risk, moderate risk, and low risk. And of course, what's good, Pat, is this is based on the last, 5 months of studying the various things. And again, you know, there's obviousness in here in a way. The big one is, Pat, they're all saying it'll be a year before we're back to large weddings. You know, shaking of hands, interestingly, they're saying nobody should shake hands for at least, you know, kind of a year is the time frame there. But it'll be a year before we don't need to wear masks or go to huge, big sporting events. That's the most remote time. But some of them said it might be sooner. So, again, there's a slight difference there. But those the good old days, basically, of going to a massive sporting event still seems to be a bit of a ways off, it must be said.
And how soon do they think that kids will get back to school in the States? Because Donald Trump is putting pressure on the governors, saying you won't get your federal funds unless you open the schools.
Yeah, that's it. Well, you see, this is very important for us as well. But we must have the kids back in school as soon as possible. Now, the main reason for that, of course, is the damage it does to children. And again, they've reopened some earlier studies that were done in the past on this with previous incidents where kids were kept from school. And it's very damaging, especially for the vulnerable groups, as we know. So our priority in Ireland and other countries, not just Ireland, of course, is to get the kids back to school as soon as we can. So they are saying 3 months in the US. Now the US is in such a bad place, as you know, Pat, it's desperate over there. But there is a massive effort to get the kids back to school, even in that environment. They're trying to come up with ways to make sure kids go back to school.
60,000 cases reported yesterday. And they've hit 3 million cases in total. So they're in a bad place, as you put it. And, you know, there's division even in the governors, be they Democrats or Republicans, as to whether or not they have done the right thing and are doing the right thing.
Well, as you know, Pat, there's still a debate rocketing around social media. Was lockdown needed? Have you seen this? Some people still think lockdown was too aggressive and too damaging. Here is a good control. No lockdown, massive spread of virus with massive horrendous consequences, you see. So we're seeing that happening now, aren't we? And of course, the big thing is those numbers predict death 2 weeks later, remember. So the death rate is predicted to skyrocket tragically in the US as well.
Mm. They're predicting by November the 1st, 200,000 deaths. It's at 132,000 at the moment in the United States. The good news, I suppose, is that there are things you can do right now, like have a picnic with friends.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. So, and of course, Ireland, we're coming top of the class at the moment, as you know, in terms of our numbers are so down in Ireland. You know, we have the lowest numbers in Western Europe now, which is fantastic. And that means we're getting towards the New Zealand levels. Now, that means things are almost fully back to normal in New Zealand. But right now in Ireland, kids can meet up. You can have a picnic outdoor activities. All those are now fully acceptable, you know, and haircuts are back. They say in America, haircuts are 3 months away because, again, they're behind us, for instance. But in Ireland, things like hiking, all that outdoor stuff is fantastic. We can do all those kinds of things now, you see. So that's great for us.
Now, you sent me a list compiled by the Texas Medical Association as to the safest things to do and the most dangerous things to do. And the safest thing to do is opening your post.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's tied into the first thing as well, because the Texas, they've looked at the things we can do now and then based on dangers and so on. And there's a great table if people want to look at it. Look at the Texas Medical Association. There's a big, beautiful diagram now with different colors in terms of risk, you know, and the lowest risk things at the moment. And this includes the US as well, by the way. A visit to a museum is definitely low risk, but a game of golf is low risk. Mm-hmm. A game of tennis is low risk. So all those stringent things happening in tennis clubs and on golf courses may not be needed because these are effectively low risk activities. Of course, you've got to mitigate against crowds gathering. That's the big one. The bar has to stay shut, at least for the moment, in those places. But yeah, things like opening letters, going shopping is low risk as well, you see. And then the moderate list, they've got flying on planes is seen as a moderate risk. Being in an office with other people, shopping malls are seen as moderate risk. That's a notch up from the low risk activities, I guess. Mm.
And then the dangerous stuff, eating at a buffet, working out at a gym, going to an amusement park, going to a movie theatre, attending a large music concert, going to a sports stadium, attending a religious service with 500 plus worshippers, and the worst thing you can do of all, go to a bar.
Well, this is deadly. And two separate studies. Now, again, we knew this from all the analysis of where super spreading events happens. A bar is easily the most risky thing we can do now, for definite. And that raises issues for us in Ireland. It's as bad as a meatpacking factory, but let's put it that way. Remember, there were outbreaks in meatpackers. Bars are like a meatpacking factory, tragically. So it's essential you mitigate in these places. You can reopen a meatpacking factory if you have massive stringent, you know, observation of all the rules. But bars are not, in both big studies, bars are absolutely the most risky thing we can do is to go into a bar. Now, of course, that's a crowded bar, by the way. So I'm saying it's not beyond the bounds of possibility you can mitigate a bit against it. But certainly bars are very extremely risky.
Now, we want to talk about the humble and rare pangolin. Because the pangolin has been linked with the spread of disease.
That's right. Yeah, well, this gets to the core of one of the key scientific questions, which remains, where did this virus come from? Now, remember, this is about stopping the next one, of course, partly. If we knew where this one came from, we can stop another one emerging. And the pangolin emerged, this was early on, as a possible species from in which the virus might have spent a while. Now, we know the bats are important. And what they do there is that they go in and look at viruses in bats and other species and see which one is the relative of the one that we have. And then the idea is that the one in the bat would have mutated and then jumped into us, say. But they found some in pangolins that are similar to the one that infects us, 92% identical in terms of the RNA. And that's quite high in this business, by the way. So there's a good chance then that this virus either came from a pangolin, that's one option, or indeed was in a bat first and then went from a bat into a pangolin and then a pangolin into us. So suddenly now the scientists are studying pangolins in great detail. And they've been studying them before for various reasons, but never with this intensity, trying to understand, you know, why would a pangolin be this intermediate species?
And what is a pangolin?
Yeah, it's a lovely creature. They've got scales, Pat, is the first thing. You may have seen them on the telly. They've got scales. They're smallish mammals, and you know they've been studied for a long time, in fact. But the problem with them is, for at least the pangolin, is they've been seen that their scales were seen to have medicinal properties. So they were hunted for their scales, and their meat is seen as a delicacy. And 100,000 now are killed every year in China for these reasons, you see. So in other words, the Chinese have been studying them for quite a while. And yet again, looking at them, scientists realise that maybe they harbour these coronaviruses, and that's the species they find the one in. And then, of course, what's extremely interesting, Pat, about them is the question is, why do they make pangolins sick? Now, as we know, if the virus is in a bat, the bat seems to be able to tolerate it. Equally, the pangolins didn't die from this virus. So they've looked at the pangolin DNA. Can you believe it? They've got some pangolin DNA, looked at it closely, and they're missing a very important immune protein that we have. It's a protein called MDA5. And bats or pangolins don't have this, a functional form of it. And we do. And this protein can drive inflammation. So you can see now, if the pangolins are missing that protein, they don't get the big hyper-inflammatory response that we get, and they survive. Now, the fact that we have it, this makes it, in fact, a colleague of mine, Andrew Bowie in Trinity, he works on MDA5, so he's very interested in this one. It's been known, it was discovered about 15 years ago as part of our immune system. So could be, this could be part of the reason why we get sick, because we have the MDA5, and the pangolin doesn't.
And could you design a drug to suppress your MDA5?
Exactly. Andrew had a big collaboration actually with the drug company AbbVie. We may have heard of AbbVie, looking for things to modulate this family of proteins. So it is within the bounds of possibility that you could develop a blocker of MDA5. And again, now who would have thought? I mean, that again, there was the pangolin is our friend in this situation, because it was the study of the pangolin that reveals MDA5 as being interesting. Now we can go after yet another target. We can explore that further.
Now, men and masks. Now, we heard Donald Trump say he reminded himself of the Lone Ranger when he wore a mask, which was strange because the Lone Ranger's mask is around his eyes.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not around his nose and mouth. Billy the Kid might have worn, a mask around his nose and mouth, but the Lone Ranger had his around his eyes. Anyway, that's Donald Trump for you. Men less likely to wear a mask than women. Why?
Well, again, what's happening here, Pat, is everybody's stepping up to try to study what's going on. You know, and psychologists and behavioral scientists are looking at mask wearing now to see, you know, why do some people wear them, why not? They are a very important weapon, as we've discussed endlessly, haven't we, you and me, over the months now. And in America, they're not wearing masks, just like here. There's places where there's lack of compliance. So again, they're wondering what's going on. And the first study that's come out that really sort of struck me was men don't wear them. And women are twice as likely to wear a mask than a man. And it's a study from Middlesex University and Berkeley University have studied this in great detail. And they're wondering, why is it that men don't wear masks? And sadly, the biggest, what do we call him, Trump? I mean, yeah, he wouldn't wear one, would he? And that was sending out a massive negative signal. I guess the first thing that comes out, Pat, is it's a political issue. Now, who would have thought something that involves common sense becomes a political issue? And one study shows 70% of Democrats will wear masks, only 37% of Republicans. Now, isn't that interesting? Massive difference there based on your politics. It shouldn't be about politics. It's supposed to be about saving you and other people. So yet it got highly politicized in America. And that's one thing that's come out. Your politics basically might govern whether you wear a mask or not.
Yeah, and the Scientific American call masks the condoms of the face, which is interesting because the whole idea is that real men don't wear condoms, you know, blah, blah, blah.
That's right.
Real men don't wear masks.
Yeah, that came from the HIV epidemic, Pat. Now, again, behavioral people looked at when HIV was a big problem. Men wouldn't wear condoms at the time. It was outrageous. And you'd say, look, this is a sexually transmitted disease. If you wear a condom, you'll reduce your risk of catching this virus, which at the time was fatal. As you remember, Pat, it was killing people. And still, a reasonable percentage of men refuse to wear them. And a lot of studies data from then. And of course, you know, the mask thing seems to be similar. And it's to do with what's called toxic masculinity. That could come up in one of these studies. Men have been found to be petulant, see themselves as indestructible and highly privileged. There were three words that were used in the study. So men have this attitude that says, look, I'm a strong macho guy. I can beat this virus myself, say HIV, for instance. I'm not going to wear a condom. That was complete nonsense because it's a highly infectious, transmissible disease and condoms protect. Same with masks, as we now know. They're a wonderful weapon to use against the virus, and yet lots of men aren't wearing them. So it's a strange one, isn't it? It's tied into, yeah, I guess this so-called toxic masculinity to some extent. They also put masks on men, Pat, and measure their emotions. Isn't that, imagine doing that. Mm-hmm. And again, negative emotions were higher in a man when he was wearing a mask than if a woman was wearing one. So there's something deep-seated in the male psyche, maybe, that makes us feel this way. And then men were asked to write down how they felt when they were wearing masks. And words like shameful, not cool, a weakness, that those words came up when they began asking men why they felt so uneasy and uncomfortable wearing masks. So I think it's a very important thing to get right, obviously, because masks are so important.
Now, the countries where they've had many, many cases, and Spain would be one of them, they're looking at the level of antibodies in families that were affected by COVID-19. What have they found?
Yeah, this is the biggest study so far, Pat, done on this. 45,000 households were examined, tens of thousands of people and who had been infected, and then they measured antibodies. I mean, these are the kind of studies we need now, proper science around the antibody question. And it's disappointing. If you're looking for a great sign that we're all going to beat this virus, the antibody studies have not really come up with much. Again, as we know, many didn't have them. Some had high levels, some had low. In many, it went away over time. And then the other thing is, around 5% of people then have been infected in Spain based on antibody detection, you see, given all the caveats. So what this means is antibodies aren't necessarily a good marker now for an immune response to this virus, which we hope they would be. Now, the media got this wrong slightly, but that doesn't mean these people are not protected, because they neglected the second part of the immune system, which is the T cells. They didn't measure T cells. And I'm not blaming them. I have to take it one step at a time, I guess. But they didn't measure T cells in the people. They just measure antibodies. And the truth is, antibodies aren't that useful. They aren't that useful, as I think this study concludes anyway. They aren't that useful as a thing to measure to see if you've been infected or not. And then certainly they won't be able to predict if you're going to be protected and not get infected again. But overall, it does suggest a low level of immunity in Spain, which was a concern, Pat, because that was one of the worst affected countries in Europe, you see. So therefore, you might expect to see higher levels of antibody because it was a more severe disease in Spain. And this study says that's not the case. Yeah. So this certainly is a study that means antibodies are going to be less of a focus, I predict, in the future. Yeah.
And is it a simple thing to measure the T cells as well? Is it a simple blood test or what?
No, well, it's more, much more. The reason why you measure antibodies first, but is they're quite easy to measure. And I know there's issues with kits and so on, but as an immune molecule, it's straightforward to measure a T cell, an antibody. It's a protein in your blood, a bit like a pregnancy test, and you can measure it. T cells are real cells, and you've got to measure ones that fight the virus. It's a much more elaborate technology. So that's why it's a bit slow, I guess, to measure them. But very importantly now, it's preliminary studies. I mean, initials yet to be published, but we're hearing rumors and seeing stuff online that we can measure T cells in people. A Swedish study actually is suggesting that you can measure T cells at a high level in people who have been infected and low level of antibodies in the same people. Do you know what I mean? In other words, take a blood sample from someone, you pick up the T cells, you don't pick up the antibodies. Now that's a good sign, Pat. That gives us hope, because T cells are really good at killing virally infected cells. What they do is they lock on to the cell that's been infected by the virus and kill it, you know? So it's a really good way to clear viruses. If this continues, Pat, and again, the focus is shifting into T cells now, let's hope that continues, and maybe you can take a blood sample and detect lots of T cells and no antibody. That's a good sign. That means you've had the infection and now those T cells are more than likely going to protect you into the future, you see. So again, what the prediction now is, we're going to shift away from antibody measurements into T cells. But the trouble is, it can't be routine. It has to be done in the hospital. It's a very elaborate technology to measure T cells. But still, it's a very important thing.
Now, there's a final thing we've come across, which is the warning of serious brain disorders in people who had mild coronavirus symptoms. And that's a worrying thing because, you know, we know people don't necessarily get their breathing back, you know, for maybe a couple of months after they've had a bad dose of COVID-19. But this is rather worrying that there might be brain damage, whether it's temporary or long term.
Yeah, there were hints of this, but this was coming out as usual in dribs and drabs as scientists began to see this and physicians in hospitals began to notice this, and some stuff was put online in some of these preprint journals. And now we have a big paper, I think you spotted it yourself, in the journal Brain, which is a very eminent journal. So UK neurologists have reported on 40 patients who had severe brain damage. Now, it's small numbers, remember. It's only a percentage of people will have this severe course. But you get a thing called acute disseminated encephalomyelitis, which, again, many of us will be aware of if you're an immunologist anyway. That's the inflammation of the brain, basically. So the virus will cause inflammation in your lungs, and that's the main organ that we worry about with respiratory failure. But we've known it goes to the brain. That was shown even 3 or 4 months ago. And lo and behold, it causes a little storm, a firestorm in your brain, and that has damaging effects. And now they're reporting on 40 patients. Now, the symptoms, Pat, are things like delirium. That's often an initial symptom, even before you have any other symptoms. Some of these people began to report delirium. And in fact, that's a well-known thing during infection, by the way. Often people get they feel a bit funny in the head because they've gotten infections. That was known, but this seems to be severe. But even worse, Pat, they're getting paralysis because you get a thing called Guillain-Barré syndrome. Again, this was known with other viral infections, by the way. And what's happening there is the inflammatory process in the brain destroys the myelin that's covering your nerves. And the myelin is like your insulation, you know, and the brain then is damaged, you see. So again, this is the first report of this. Now, again, it's rare, thankfully, but still it's something that they're going to keep an eye on now, because this is a very good study that's really sort of consistently showing this.
Now, we're still with Professor Luke O'Neill, Professor of Biochemistry at Trinity College in Dublin. As Stephen Bray says, can we talk about the reported outbreak of bubonic plague now in China? How come it's not being covered much? What are the dangers? And just from CNN, authorities in the Chinese region of Inner Mongolia have closed several tourist spots after a case of bubonic plague was confirmed this week. It was discovered in Bayanur, located northwest of the capital Beijing. 5 nearby grassland scenic points have now been closed, with visitors strictly prohibited from entering the affected areas. Luke, bubonic plague, is it something to worry about?
Yeah, if another thing to upset us in a way, isn't it? I mean, this is the famous Black Death. Remember, that was caused by the bubonic plague all those years ago. And there's been several plagues through human history, as we know. At the moment, no. I mean, we can treat this. It's caused by bacteria. Remember, the name of the bacteria is Yersinia. And there's antibiotics to treat this, you know, so it is obviously it's a very treatable disease, not like it was in the Dark Ages. So, but they watch it closely, Pat, just in case there's a variant, if you like, that's resistant to antibiotics, for instance. So they look at that extremely closely, because it's a very, obviously it was a dangerous disease. You know, the Black Death, Pat, killed a third of the world's population back in medieval times. So it's a nasty bacteria, but as I say, there's ways to treat it. So, but still, it's one to watch. Just occasionally you get bubonic plague breaking out. It isn't that unusual. You know, you do see occasional little outbreaks here and there. It's still lingering. It just shows you how some germs can still be around, even though they've been going around for centuries. So it's not a big thing to worry about, but it's certainly one to keep an eye on.
Yeah. The single case is a herdsman who's in hospital and is in a stable condition. Now, this is an interesting one from Sandra. Could you please ask, when can people get tested for the antibodies? I was in ICU in St. Vincent's Hospital for Christmas and the New Year with identical symptoms of the coronavirus. I'm still struggling physically and mentally. I've been in touch with the HSE and my GP, and I've been told I can't get tested yet.
Yes, I wonder. Yeah, I mean, as I said earlier, the measuring of antibodies is less interesting in truth, because you may well have had that, that person may have had the disease and they've gone away anyway and they'll be negative. That's the first possibility. Secondly, even if you have them, it's no guarantee of protection. We need to start measuring the T cells in people as the next thing, basically. But there does seem to be a bit of a delay. People want to know, I suppose, and that's understandable. So, and they're not difficult to measure in a hospital setting. It's quite straightforward to measure antibodies, you see. So it should be possible to get antibodies measured, really.
Now, this is a question about memory B and T cells in the body, or antibodies, which provides long-term immunity. Also, why do we not build up long-term immunity against diseases like herpes that we can suffer from throughout life? You get an eruption of herpes from time to time.
These are great questions. That must be an immunologist, Pat, because when I give my lectures, I spend two or three lectures on that single topic. We don't really know. Some viruses go latent, so they hide somewhere and then they reemerge, you know, and when they reemerge, then they infect you a second time, kind of thing. And you haven't built up sufficient immunity the first time. And herpes, they live in your nerve cells, incredibly. They hide in there and can suddenly re-erupt. And it's a bit of a mystery. Sometimes if you're immunosuppressed, of course, the virus now begins to grow again from the nerves and you get some of the symptoms. Or if your stress brings it out, by the way, because stress will suppress the immune system. And now you get a cold sore on your lip, you see. So, but we still don't fully understand why that is. It's a big area of research. Now, the memory cells, exactly. That's a fantastic question, because this is what it's all about. If you have an immune response and you bring these T and B cells out, they do their job. They clear the infection. Some of them go back to the barracks, if you like, you know, and wait for the next attack. And they're called memory cells. So the immune system has a memory in it. And that's, they're measuring. Now, that what the good news here, but it's the Swedish that I mentioned earlier, that still hasn't been published, but we've heard this. They're measuring memory T cells in people who've had COVID. That's a fantastic development if that's true, because those are highly trained troops. And when the virus comes back in again, they kill it on contact. They've been trained to recognize it, you see. So it's all about the memory response. This business of memory is central to immunity, of course.
Now, a text about the Lewis from a passenger, no doubt. Saw most people wearing their masks this morning on the Lewis, so well done. Ask Luke, how safe or otherwise is air conditioning? It's on all the time in my office.
This is one of the answers, Pat. Now, I think the reopening of pubs, by the way, we need to have fantastic ventilation, because we know ventilation is a huge mitigator. This is where the engineers come in. And what's happening, Pat, is engineers and aerosol engineers are now publishing papers and discussing what the ventilation should be like. Isn't that wonderful? Because they know all about ventilation and airflow and all those things. If you have a crappy old ventilating machine, it'll be hopeless, because it'll just recirculate the air and won't clean it. So it's all about the grade of the ventilator now, and how many filters you have, and how many times the air is exchanged in a room. And again, they're looking at this closely, you see. And obviously the people who own airplanes, it's very relevant if you're stuck in an airplane. So the whole area of ventilation now is being ramped up, if you like. One thing that we'll get out of this part is better ventilators, let's put it that way, because in the sense of a ventilation for a room, because that's such an important weapon indoors. You're trying to recreate what's outdoors indoors, you see, which we know is a big decrease in risk if you're outdoors. So if ventilation can achieve that, that's a great achievement to really mitigate against infection.
Yeah, because you wonder if you're getting secondhand air from the floor above or the floor below when you're being ventilated by air conditioning, rather than getting fresh air coming into your space.
Right.
Interesting comment from a listener in Galway. Recently flew with Ryanair to Portugal. All cabin crew and passengers were wearing masks. Also, over here in Portugal, you're not allowed into any building without a mask. It's compulsory over here and frowned upon if you're not wearing one, and there's a possible fine. The Portuguese are welcoming tourists as long as you adhere to their rules. It's a joke at home. We feel a lot safer here than we do in Ireland. So Ireland has a lot to learn, says the listener from Galway. And that's the point, isn't it? That if everyone adheres to the rules, then you can go about normal business relatively safely.
That is so important, Pat. We should be doing exactly what Portugal is doing. Not just Portugal, by the way. Certain parts of the states are the same now, because they realise, let's get the mask thing right. You know, Minnesota just mandated mask wearing, and it's a fine. You know, if you're not wearing the on-the-spot fines are in Boston. Even though basically governments know, how do you get people to wear masks? You introduce all this, you see, to ensure, if you're serious about masks, you've got to do exactly all these things. Otherwise, there won't be enough people wearing them. Now, I must say, on the Dart, it's got better for definite. I mean, I it's more like 60% I counted, you know. It was only 10% 2 weeks ago. So we're beginning to get there. But certainly, we've got to do better. And these kinds of measures would ensure that mask wearing is complied with.
Now, well, here's a despondent person in Dundalk. I'm at a stage where I'm ready to quit wearing a mask. I'm from Dundalk and I believe compliance is in single digits here. So what's the point? Because we always made the point on this programme, at least, that my mask protects you and your mask protects me. So he's saying, well, I'm protecting everyone else from me, but they're not protecting me from them.
Don't give up. Don't give up.
Yeah.
No, well, I wear it all the time because it sends a signal to others. If I'm walking down the street and I've got a mask on, then, maybe I should wear one, you know, and it might increase compliance if at least some of us wear them, you know.
Is it safe to use gym, swimming pools now? Someone else about swimming pools, given that, you know, you've got chlorine in the pool. But what about the warm, humid environment, poolside and in the changing rooms from Dave in Westmeath?
Yeah, those two big studies put swimming pools in the moderate risk. They're not high risk, but they're moderate. I think that's mainly because of crowds gathering at pools rather than the pool itself. So if you go for a swim in a pool, there's not many people around, that's a very low risk activity. If there's lots of crowds, then that might be an issue. I guess that's why they put the swimming pools into the moderate risk range. But in general, swimming pools should be fine. Gyms are a problem, Pat, because, again, contact, intense activity, all the virus comes out, you know, when you're exerting yourself. So again, that's about numbers of people, I guess, and also ventilation. If they're observed, then gyms become low risk. You can move down the table if you adopt certain measures, you see. Obviously, things that were high become low if you're mitigating. Mm.
A couple more. Please ask about hand dryers in toilets. Now, I've often wondered about that. You know, if you get we know how many bugs spring out when you flush the loo, and there are, you know, pictures you can see of the spray that comes out of the loo. You can't see it, but the cameras can see it. And then, you know, all this stuff is floating around the place and you warm it up in a hand dryer.
Yeah, no, toilets are high risk, Pat. I mean, in the pub itself is high risk. If you go into a toilet, the risk goes up even higher because, first of all, everybody's going in and out. You know, obviously there's people in there and they could be leaving deposits of virus on surfaces. You know, all that sort of hygiene stuff becomes highly relevant. One recommendation, Pat, have you seen Bord Fault Shift said, you should wear a mask when you go to the toilet in a pub and take it off again when you go back to your table. Now, how many people are going to do that? But that just shows you how toilets are a high-risk environment for definite, and hand dryers don't help, that's for sure.
And the final question, could you please ask Luke about a choir of 50 rehearsing in a church, how to stay safe?
Very difficult. Choirs are second to pubs, Pat, by the way, on all those tables as risky things, you know, to do. The only way to mitigate in a choir is to sing outdoors. That's the first thing. I know it's difficult to say that to people. It sounds ridiculous in a way, but you've got to go outdoors to practice. That's the safest thing to do. If you are in a massive big church with huge ventilation, it's a bit like being outdoors, obviously. So that might be okay as long as you're socially distanced from each other and there's a good bit of ventilation blowing through. But you're much better off being outdoors. That's one way to mitigate against risk for choir with proper social distancing.
All right. Luke O'Neill, Professor of Biochemistry at Trinity College in Dublin. Thank you very much for joining us. You know.